That could have been a lot worse.
That crap had better than that.
No, worse. Worse. All right, we are in Hebrews chapter 9. Seems like a month since we've been in our Hebrew study, and I've missed it. So I'm glad to be back. Hope you can share those sentiments as well. Much of our study tonight is going to involve around the tabernacle. We're going to start off with verses 1 through 5. We'll see why he's talking about the tabernacle. We're going to review a little bit about that. The tabernacle was a centerpiece. It's part of the Old Testament and the way that they worship God under the law of Moses. And so we'll make some observations about that. And all of this is in view of, as you look back to the things that were and now the things that are in Christ, is to show the superiority of Jesus, the superiority of the priesthood, the superiority of the covenant, the superiority of the promises. And now we're going to look at the holy place, and we're going to see how there's a superior sacrifice. That's what much of chapter 9 is about. Okay, and so I realize that I just kind of answered that. But let's go ahead and, man, if you still got these questions, I'll be impressed because it's been a while since we've been in Hebrews 9. There are probably a few handouts left in the back. If you don't have that and you'd like to grab one, that may help you follow along or maybe prepare a little bit. We'll be here for a few weeks. But let's go ahead and think about the big picture of Hebrews chapter 9. What are we looking at? What's the writer going to be talking about? Okay, comparing the old covenant and the new. All right. Dave?
Perfect sacrifice.
Okay, perfect sacrifice. Yep. Much of that, bringing the tabernacle in, is going to show revolving around the sacrifice. That's where the sacrifices were offered. And we'll see some other things that were done there as well. But really ultimately pointing to and comparing it to the sacrifice of Jesus. Right. Anybody else? So here's my summation. The chapter 9 is about through his own blood, Jesus has entered into the heavenly sanctuary to minister on our behalf in the presence of God. Remember what Moses was told when he went up to receive the instruction for the tabernacle? He was to build it how? According to what? Yeah, according to the pattern. Okay, that was chapter 8. Build the tabernacle according to the pattern. Okay, and so he's going to start out and he's going to really talk about some of the various elements of the tabernacle that they used under the Old Testament, under the Old Law. And so we'll read and just kind of review some of those things and then make our way through the text. Let's hold that up for right now. Let's read first from Hebrews 9, 1 through 5. He says, "Now even the first covenant had regulations for worship and an earthly place of holiness. For a tent was prepared, the first section in which were the lampstand and the table and the bread of the presence. It's called the holy place. Behind the second curtain was a second section called the most holy place, having the golden altar of incense and the ark of the covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden urn holding the manna, and Aaron's staff that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. Above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things we cannot speak in detail." So let me just kind of walk us through the set up of the arrangement of the tabernacle, the earthly tabernacle through which they worshiped under the law of Moses. Firstly, what does the word tabernacle mean? Okay, tent. Pretty good definition, maybe a little abstract. Tabernacle really carries with it the idea of dwelling. In fact, you go back and you look in John's Gospel in John chapter 1, it says the Word became flesh and the Word, you know, many translations say, dwelt among us. But some translations, you look at that, it says that the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. And if you think of what the tabernacle was, this was going to be a place where the presence of God would come and where God would dwell among the people. And it was a tent that was set up, but it was also encapsulating the idea of the dwelling place of God. And under the old law, it was a portable dwelling place that was built by Moses and many of the other artisans and tradespersons. And it was used as a place where God would come and be among the people until the temple came into effect. And when the temple came into effect, then God had placed his name in the city of Jerusalem. And so it was a more stable, located place where God would dwell. Tabernacle dwelt in various locations, at least four different locations, I think, before the temple came along. However, it was later replaced by the temple, which would provide a more permanent place. Now, the arrangement of the tabernacle and the arrangement of the temple is largely the same. tabernacle itself was divided into three parts, as you can see there. The outer courtyard, the holy place, and the holy of holies. Okay, so when you come into the courtyard, you can kind of see a couple of objects there. The first of those is a bronze altar, or the altar of burnt offering. It's made of acacia wood and was overlaid in bronze. And sometimes you'll hear it referred to as the bronze altar, or if you use the King James Version, it'll be referred to as the brazen altar. So it's pretty big because it was for exactly what you think it was. It was 7.5 feet long, 7.5 feet wide, and stood about 4.5 feet tall. So there are horns on the four corners of it, as well as all of the pots and shovels and various other utensils that would be needed for the sacrifices. So this was the first thing you saw when you entered into the tabernacle area. And it was obviously to remind the people that you've got to deal with sin before you enter into the presence of God. This is where the burnt offerings were and the sin offerings and the various other offerings were made. So bronze is a harder metal than silver or gold. And so for the work of offering sacrifices and for holding the fire, it would be the place, it would be the material that would best be used to function in this way. Animal blood would be taken and thrown against the base of it. Various portions of the sacrifices were burned on top of it. Certain meat and drink offerings were poured out on it as libations and sacrifices to the Lord. Shortly after that, before you entered into the holy place, and only priests are going to be able to enter into the holy place, but you have there the laver. And the priest would have to go and he'd have to wash his hands and his feet before he went into the holy place. If he didn't do that, then he could die. He would die. So that was part of the construction of the tabernacle before he went in and entered into the holy place and served the Lord there. He had to wash his hands and his feet. Then you go into the holy place, and what you'll find is the table of showbread sitting right there. It was a small little table that held 12 loaves of bread in stacks of six. It was thrown out. The oil was set out. Actually, it wasn't thrown out. It was set out for the priest. So if you were a priest, you could eat from the table of showbread. After the new loaves had been replaced in, and every Sabbath day they would bake new loaves, and they would keep that there. Sometimes you'll hear that called the bread of the presence. Okay, and that's because it sat there in the presence of the Lord, and 12 meaning indicating what? Yeah, the 12 tribes, okay, symbolic of the people of Israel. So you have the bread of the presence or the table of showbread there, replaced every Sabbath. Priests were allowed to eat of it as long as they were consecrated, eating of it in a holy place. There's one exception to that. Can you remember somebody that ate from the table of showbread that wasn't a priest? David? Wow, that was an easy question. You guys are really on it. All right, anybody know the circumstances going on that caused David to need to eat from the table of showbread? Right, he's on the run, right? Saul was chasing after him. Didn't have anything to eat. He also asked for one other thing when he went there. Do you remember what it was? Yeah, he said he got a weapon, okay, and the sword of Goliath was there. So David and his men were allowed for emergency purposes to eat from the table of showbread. The priest did say, well, are you and the men clean? And he said, yes, we are. So they were able to, and Jesus actually uses that a little bit later on to help us understand, in a sense, the spirit of the law. Okay, so you have the table of showbread there, and then you would have the lampstand. Sometimes it's called the menorah. That's more of a modern term, though, but it had a central stem and then three branching off on each side, and it was fresh olive oil, and it was placed in the seven heads and would burn from evening until morning. Then you'd have the altar of incense, once again made out of acacia wood, and was about 18 inches square and 3 feet high. We'll say this is what the priest burned incense on daily. So he'd burn it with the morning sacrifice, and he'd burn it in the evening with the evening sacrifice. Now, the coals that were used on the altar of incense had to come from a special location. That is, they had to be gotten from, remember, the bronze altar on the outside. Okay, so you had to bring the coals in from the bronze altar, and that's what you would use to light the fire and burn the altar of incense in the holy place. And the priest would then pronounce a priestly blessing on the people. Can you think of any significant events that happened involving the altar of incense throughout the Bible? Think of any important things that happened around it? All right. Yeah, Nadab and Abihu, what happened with them? Wrong fire, strange fire. Yep, and that's why I said you had to get the altar. The priests were commanded. You had to get the fire, coals, from the bronze altar of sacrifice. That's what you used to burn the incense. And so strange fire came from a place where it wasn't specified whether it was fire that they had brought along or fire that they'd gotten from another location. We don't know exactly what it was, but it didn't come from the right place because the Lord had commanded you bring the coals from the bronze altar, and that's what you used to burn the incense. They didn't do that. And the result of that was The fire came out and it devoured them. Okay, so and then God told Aaron, he told the people, before those who come into my presence, you're to regard me as holy. Okay, and so that really sent a very significant lesson to the people to trust, to honor the Lord, and to come and to bring to Him the worship that He had commanded them, and not to deviate from that. All right, that's one example. Can you think of another? There's a couple more. That's Leviticus 10. If anybody was interested in reading more about that, Nadab and Abihu. We've been looking at one with our study in Luke 1. Remember? Zechariah. He was in the most holy place, burning all incense on the altar of incense when the angel Gabriel appeared and spoke to him. And then there's one more that I know of. It's a king named Uzziah, who was a good king. However, he became proud, became arrogant, decided he was going to take on himself some of the priestly responsibilities. And so he enters into the holy place, and he burns incense on the altar of incense. The result, once again, is catastrophic. If you're not from the tribe of Levi, if you're not a priest, you can't do that. You're outside of God's authority. And so the Lord struck him with leprosy. And he was quickly ushered out, and you know, he was no longer fit to rule over the people from that point. So the altar of incense, that was done in the morning to accompany the morning sacrifice and the evening sacrifice, and the people would be blessed by the priest. Okay, then we go into what's called the most holy place. And let me just flip back to our big picture. I should have interspersed that. So you have the outer courtyard with the bronze altar and the laver. Then you have the holy place with the table of showbread, the candle, and your altar of incense. Then you have the what's called the Holy of Holies, or that's just a Hebrew way of a Hebrew superlative, which means the most holy place. You have the Ark of the Covenant, which is the most serious and most important of all of the components of the tabernacle. Between the most holy place and the holy place, you would have the veil separating those two things. It was blue, purple, and scarlet, and it was embroidered with cherubim. So this is probably the most important piece of the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant. It was this relatively small box of acacia wood overlaid with gold, 3 foot long, 2 foot and 3 inches wide, and 2 foot and 3 inches tall, with a crown molding, or a little molding at the top you can see around there, with two cherubim on the top, their wings pointed together. And this part of it here, this is a lid, really, is what it is. You got an open box here. And this is the lid that's set on top of it, called the mercy seat, okay? Sometimes you hear God called or referred to as the God who dwells between the cherubim. That's a reference to the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant, where God's presence was said to come down on top of the mercy seat. Okay, so that's the Ark of the Covenant there for you. And in it, they kept three things. They kept manna, they kept Aaron's rod that budded, and they kept the Ten Commandments. So all of those things were inside the Ark, and above that was the mercy seat where God would meet with the high priest and speak to the people. So with that being said, let's kind of jump into our verses. Any questions or comments on the tabernacle up to this point? All right, let's look at the first couple of verses. Hebrew writer says, "Now even the first covenant had regulations for worship in an earthly place of holiness. For a tent was prepared, the first section in which were the lampstand, the table, the bread of the presence. It's called the holy place." So the regulations for worship are the things that were set forth, the instruments and the various laws that God has set in place in Numbers and in Leviticus for the priests to follow as to how God was to be worshipped. You didn't tamper with those. You got in big trouble if you tried to bypass some of the things that God has set in place. It's called an earthly place of holiness, that is the tabernacle. So you think about the tabernacle as to why it was holy. It was holy because that was where God dwelt among the people. After it was completed, the Shekinah glory came down, and it says it filled the tabernacle. Okay, and so in some sense, that was the dwelling place of God among the people. And so it was holy also because not anybody could go in there. Only priests could go in, and Levites could go in to a certain degree and help with various various tasks that needed to be done. So it wasn't a place that just anybody could go. And that's part of the reason we see the superiority of the New Covenant and the way that we worship under the New Covenant and the Old Covenant and all of the laws and limitations and reminders that you know there's this great separation between you and between God. So it was this holy place, verses 3 and 4, behind the second curtain was a section called the Most Holy Place, having golden the golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant, covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden urn holding the manna, Aaron's staff that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. So what was the significance of the objects kept in the Ark of the Covenant? The three things that were in there.
They were, of course, the tablets were the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
That was God's, and all three of them together made the covenant. That was part of the covenant.
Okay. Yep. That's part of it. Dave, you look like you're wanting to talk. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, there's all right. Yeah. Let me ask maybe a more specific question that maybe I should have just asked to begin with, kind of guide where I'm going with this. What is the negative that's associated with each of these things, because there's something negative associated with each one? What was the negative associated with the manna? You remember? Yeah, the ingratitude of the people. Okay, they complained about the manna. They got sick and tired of eating the manna. Remember, the Lord sent a plague among the people because they were griping, because they were ungrateful. Okay, so the manna was a picture of God's provision and the people's ingratitude. The Ten Commandments were a picture of God's law. And what did the people do? Didn't take them long to break them, did they? I mean, they broke them. They disobeyed them. So there's a picture of the Ten Commandments, God's law, God's gracious law, and their failure to keep those. And then Aaron's rod that budded. Do you remember how that came about? You had these discontents, malcontents, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and they stir up the people. And they say, why do you priests think you're so special? All of Israel's holy. We should all be able to partake in the various workings of the tabernacle and serving the Lord in that way. Okay, and so what Moses does is he said, you, every man, leader from each individual tribe, the 12 tribes, bring a staff. Okay, they bring their staffs, they put Aaron's down. God sets forth and shows Aaron's the one who's chosen. Aaron's rod buds. That's why the Aaron's rod budded. It was a demonstration that God was choosing him to be the one who would, him and his family, that would offer the priestly service. But coupled along with that, remember, is Korah's rebellion. That was the purpose of the whole thing. He stirred the people up, caused them to be discontent, to speak evil of Moses and Aaron, question their authority. And so you've got the Ten Commandments, the manna, the Aaron's staff that budded, all of those things which are symbolic of God's grace to the people, but which also carry to the people, from the people's perspective, this this rejection, this disobedience. Okay? And so, sitting on top of those is what? It's the mercy seat. So, God looks down, what does he see? Well, they're in the Ark of the Covenant, they're reminders of what the people have done and what God's done, but you also have God's mercy covering that. Okay? So, that's kind of one of the connections that I made. So, there were those objects there that were to remind them not just of what God had done to them, but how they've responded to God's grace. And God's mercy seat covered that, and it was sprinkled with blood so that God was able to be gracious to them rather than to deal with them as they deserved. You want to say something, Dave?
No, I just had egg on my face because I was thinking of the plague I was talking about.
Oh. So, I got you. Well, he did have the staff. Aaron's staff was very relevant then, wasn't it? Because he told Aaron, you go cut yourself a staff, and that was what was used primarily whenever the plagues were involved. He touched the staff and the water and various other things. So his staff was involved with that, yeah. So there's a correlation there. Don't beat yourself up too bad. All right, so all of these things are inside the ark with the mercy seat covering it. It's in a sense representative of not just the grace of God, but the sins of the people. And so on the Day of Atonement, the high priest would go in, he'd sprinkle blood on the mercy seat, and God would look at the ark, he'd see men's failure, he'd see men's sin, but covering it would be the seat of mercy, wherewith was sprinkled the blood, thus satisfying the demand that justice be applied to the people's sins. So, are you starting to see the significance of these elements and these events? He's made the point that Jesus is the better high priest. He's already shown how the new covenant is a better covenant. So in chapters 9 and 10, what we're going to see is a better sacrifice. That was what much of the setting up of the tabernacle was for. was so that the people could offer sacrifices. The high priest could offer sacrifices for sin from the people. So, one quick question. Where was the altar of incense? Where's the altar of incense at?
Okay,
yeah, and this is why I asked the question. Where does the writer, Hebrew writer, make it sound like it's at?
Yeah,
he makes it sound like it's inside the most holy place. But when you go back and you read, from best my research showed, is it was actually stationed right outside of the Holy of Holies before you went in. But he kind of speaks of it as it were there among the most holy place. He actually didn't state, I don't think, that it was behind the curtain of the most holy place. It was situated directly in front of the most holy place on the outside of the veil. And I think the reason he kind of speaks of it in that way is because, yes, it was used daily to burn the incense, but it was also used on the special Day of Atonement whenever the priest would go in to the most holy place. One of the things he would have to do, he'd have to go in and he'd use some of the coals that were in the altar of incense. The first time he goes in, I think, three times. He goes in, he cleanses himself, and then he goes in and he offers the sacrifice and sprinkles the blood, rather, on the Ark of the Covenant. First time he goes in, he has to carry this little thing in, and it starts smoking. Okay, so if you remember, the most holy place is where the Ark of the Covenant was, dwelling place of God. And if he went in without that smoking that he got from the altar of incense, then he could be struck down. And so you do see some involvement of the altar of incense in the function of the holy place. And I think that's why he probably incorporates that in. That actually comes from Leviticus 16, 12, and 13, where it says, "He shall take a censer full of coals of fire from the altar before the Lord, and two handfuls of sweet incense beaten small, and he shall bring it inside the veil." So he carries that in, inside the veil, and puts the incense on the fire before the Lord, and the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is over the testimony, so that he doesn't die. So, the presence of God is there. The smoke kind of protects him, symbolically protected him, as he goes into the most holy place and prepares to sprinkle the blood on the Ark of the Covenant. So, although it's located in the holy place, there's some functionality in which it's associated with the most holy place. And maybe you picked up on that, maybe you didn't. But that's why I think the Hebrew writer kind of speaks of it as if it were in the most holy place, is because of its affiliation with that particular activity on the Day of Atonement. So on verse 5, he says, "Above it," so that is above the Ark of the Covenant, "were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things we cannot now speak in detail." So on top of the mercy seat were the cherubim of glory. Think back, where else do you see cherubim in the Bible? Think of any other places? Yep. All right. So he put a cherubim there in the entrance of the Garden of Eden after he ran Adam and Eve out. Yep. Okay. That's one spot. We also remember, we see them there. They're on the mercy seat. And then you have the temple period a thousand years later. Two cherubim are inside with their wings once again touching. So think of those places. The Holy of Holy above the Ark of the Covenant. The holy, most holy place inside the temple. The entrance to the Garden of Eden. What are all of those, the cherubim, seem to be associated with? What's that?
Security.
Okay. Security. I do think you kind of see them functioning in that role, like a security. What are they securing? Whose presence are they?
The presence of God.
Yeah. That's what I was getting at. They're in the presence of God, and I think you're right, Jim, that they're kind of, particularly back in the Garden of Eden, they're barring the entrance back into the presence of God. But in Eden, in the tabernacle on the Ark of the Covenant, in the temple, in the most holy place, there's this presence of God. And you could go into Ezekiel and Revelation, and you could probably see, I think, cherubim are there. Revelation doesn't call them that, but it gives a description of Ezekiel, and I think Ezekiel calls them cherubim. And so there are these spiritual beings that are associated with the presence of God. And as I said, remember, God sometimes described as the God who dwells above the cherubim. So they're associated with the presence of God. And then speaking of all of these things, the tabernacle and the worship and all of these things we cannot now speak in detail. So more can be said about that, but he's got other points he's wanting to make. So let's move on to that in verses 6 through 10. These preparations having thus been made, the priest goes regularly into the first section, performing the ritual duties. But into the second, only the high priest goes, and he but once a year, and not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the unintentional sins of the people. By this the Holy Spirit indicates that the way into the holy place is not yet opened, as long as the first section is still standing, which is symbolic for the present age. According to this arrangement, gifts and sacrifices are offered that cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper, but deal only with food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until the time of Reformation. So here you say, why are we talking about the tabernacle? Why we spent most of this class talking about the tabernacle? Why does he speak in detail about the tabernacle? I think the latter part of that captures that. Because the gifts and sacrifices that were offered there at the tabernacle cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper. And we'll get more into that later in the chapter and also in chapter 10. So the Hebrew writer now moves from the arrangement to the ritual itself. He separates the work of the lower priest to that of the high priest. So the lower priests, they normally go into the holy place. They burn the incense. They'd offer the sacrifice on the brazen altar. They'd perform the ritual duties, set out the holy loaves. They trim the lamp. Really what he's got in mind, though, is the special work of the high priest, because that's the comparison that's going to be made to Jesus. Okay? Jesus isn't just any old priest. Jesus is compared to the high priest, like the high priests of old, but even better. So thinking about all of this, why might God have placed all of these restrictions on the entrance into the most holy place? Why did he do that? Why might he have done that?
It's an obedience thing.
Okay.
He
expects them to obey it, certainly. And we've seen in history those who disobeyed, it didn't work out. They were punished. Yeah, that was part of it. So I think we've got some other things going on, though. What's he trying to show? I think there's a couple of things he wants us to see, one of the people to see, and we can see it as well as we look back at things that were. However, at the same time, these truths are just as much true for us in our relationship with God and as it would have been for them. One, he wants us to see the holiness of the Lord. What does holy mean? Set apart. It's the idea of separate. Okay, so you've got all of these things that are barring access to God, right? You've got the priests are the only ones who can enter into the holy place. There's only one man, though, that can enter into the most holy place. And then you got the veil that's there separating the holy place and the most holy place. And he's got to offer the sacrifices, and he's got to enter with the smoke. And so there's just reminder after reminder that God is separate from you. Okay, God is separate from the people. The people are sinful. God is holy. And so there's a separation between the two of them. And I think that's one of the things he wants us to see as to why all these restrictions are placed to really keep the people out. And also to show the effect that sin has on our relationship to God. You know, as we look back at this, what are we learning today? Well, one of the things we learn is this is what sin does to your relationship with God. Okay, it puts you at arm's length. It makes it so you can't go into God's presence. Okay, so all of those things were there. And some of the things helped take care of sin so that one could go in and enter into the presence of God. But perhaps most significantly, and what I think we're going to see as we get further into chapter 9, is this is a foreshadowing of one who's going to go into the most holy place, where other men couldn't go except one time a year with much labor and much effort and much cleansing and much purification. One's going to come in and he's going to go in there and he's not going to leave. Okay, he's going to stay. Because remember, going back to chapter 8, he's harmless and pure and undefiled and free from sin. Okay, and so you see the inadequacy of the Levitical priesthood in functioning and being the high priest that they need and being able to offer a sacrifice that would care for sin. All of that pointing to what? Jesus, who is later going to come and is going to fulfill and be able to do what all of the priests for thousands of years weren't able to do. So, you know, that's kind of where I was going with that. Why the restriction? Why the distance? Because Jesus is going to do, and he's going to ultimately fulfill in a much better way that which the Old Testament priesthood couldn't. So I'll just touch on this one last thing. In Leviticus chapter 16, you have there the events that happened on the Day of Atonement. So this was where the high priest would go, and he would enter into the most holy place that one day a year. Here's what would happen. He'd kill a bull as a sin offering for himself, and he'd take a censer full of coals of fire from the altar. And as he entered the most holy place, he'd burn a couple of handfuls of this incense so that smoke would cover the mercy seat so that he might not be destroyed. And he would die if he didn't do this. Then he sprinkled the mercy seat on the east side and sprinkled it from the front side 7 times. And after having offered that sacrifice for himself and his family, then he'd go out and he'd kill another goat. And then he'd come back in and he'd sprinkle it again on behalf of the people. Okay? And so this is how atonement was made. So all of these things are just pointing us to the fact of what man was not able to do, of what couldn't be accomplished under the priesthood of old, and what Jesus is going to accomplish in a much better way, in a much truer and fuller sense. So we'll pick up with that thought next week, talking about more so the fulfillment of the perfect sacrifice that Jesus is going to make. Dick?
What you just said, that reminded me of the incense. It had to be outside the veil because they only went inside there once a year.
Yeah.
And they used that thing daily.
Yeah. It was positioned outside.
It does sound like it.
Yeah, and like I said, I think that's just its correlation in its use on the Day of Atonement in association with the most holy place, that it's kind of described in the manner that it is. All right, we'll pick up next week in verses 8 through 10.